Welcome to Real Estate I Love It podcast. I'm Shelley Hoffman, real estate expert and community advisor. Join me and various guests who are expert in what they do, such as home inspectors, mortgage brokers, investors, wholesalers. There are so many aspects to our industry that most people are not aware of, and I'm here to help you learn about them. I'm an educator by trade, and this podcast is to educate you in the world of real estate. Hey everybody, it's Shelley Hoffman, and I have Jason Miller, Rob Just, Steve Ladd, and Christy Brightman here again today as we kind of go through the real estate process, hopefully answering some questions along the way. And today's topic, we're going to throw to Christy because it's all about the attorney side of the transaction. You know, like I said, I put a contract together, I go through it with my buyers or my sellers, and then we send it off to the attorneys. And their next question is, what does the attorney do with it? So Christy, I'm going to throw it to you to kind of start that conversation with everybody as far as what happens when you get that signed purchase contract.
Sure. So typically we get it. We'll take a peek through just to see if there's anything strange that we don't normally see. But it's a form contract. So typically, you know, it's the same stuff, just different timelines or potential waivers of certain contingencies. We send out an email to the buyer, the potential buyer or the seller, depending on where we are, to like go through any comments, questions, concerns that we have. We have way more on a buyer side than a sale side. Usually with the seller, it's, hey, FYI, these are the closing kind of timelines. Can you close on that date? Or should we be thinking about adjusting it right now? Because you tell me that, you know, your new build isn't going to be ready for 6 months or something. But with buyers, the list is a lot longer, especially right now. There's obviously the home inspection waivers that are happening that we've been talking about. That always gets flagged for us because we just want to make sure that this is your last chance to really give it up. Once we get past this point, there is no going back to say, oh, I really kind of think I wanted to take another look. So we make the request, you know, we do caution that this can let the seller walk away. And if that's not something you want to do, then we won't do it. But beware that you're going to take it as you take it. And if that means that the foundation's crumbling or the roof is leaking, then that's just going to be what it's going to be, unfortunately. So that one, the other big thing that we end up flagging in our email to everybody is taxes. Because right now homes are going for a lot more than their assessed value most of the time. You know, I think I saw one that was assessed at like two and it was going for 350. So when you talk about the tax increase that you may see when the assessor gets hip to what's going on or decides that they're going to do that revaluation full town wide, then you're going to see a huge increase in taxes because that's basically another house, right? So can you afford that when we all look at all of this, literally, like actually dollars in, dollars out and out? Did the bank say you can afford it? But from a day in, day out cash flow perspective, does that work for you? And I've had some people pause and go, oh, I don't know. I mean, they still went through with it, but, you know, they at least thought about it for half a second.
You know, can I ask a question about that before we go forward to the next part? Because, and this is going to go back to you, Jason, because obviously, you know, from the lending side of it, you give the pre-approval. And you sometimes you put the taxes in there. So Christy and Jason, if I have a pre-approval letter attached to it, and they're pre-approved for X amount of dollars, and they're going to bring more cash to closing, which we can talk about another session about the appraisal gap and stuff. But is that a concern? Do you ever tell them to go back to their lender to make sure that when those taxes do go up, they can still afford the house? Because Jason, isn't that kind of part of the things you guys look at when you look at the taxes for a pre-approval?
Yeah, we have to qualify them based on the actual taxes without any exemptions. So, you know, a lot of times there'll be star exemptions or veterans exemptions, things like that on there. So we pull up the taxes and look at them. And then, like, I have a gal right now who is talking about different amounts down that she wants to put down to try and keep a payment in a certain range. And so I pointed out to her that, you know, the taxes were based on this assessed value and she's paying significantly more. And that I directed her to actually call the town and that, you know, to say, hey, if you guys reassess this at the amount I'm paying for, what would it do for my taxes? Then that way she's hearing it from the town themselves instead of me. You know, I can do some calculations, but I'd rather, you know, put the liability on the town and then have them do their research. And then she's going to come back to me and say, here's what they said. And then we'll go ahead and, you know, run those numbers accordingly. But I always tell people, this girl's actually in contract right now. So she's passed attorney approvals, all those things. But I tell people before they put an offer in to look at those things and get a hold of me so we can run all the numbers and make sure some people listen and others just kind of do a bat's backwards, you know.
Well, they're excited to get the, at this point, right? They're excited to get the house. But when you mention that, Chrissy, it just goes back to how we all have to work together through the entire process. Mm-hmm. But I didn't think about that. Like, you know, you are their last chance of if those taxes or something are going to be too high. Because once you approve it, that's not a contingency. They'd lose their deposit, right? I'm assuming. Okay. So I didn't mean to interrupt the process, but I wanted to like kind of tie that together for everybody how it works.
Yeah. So the taxes are a big thing right now, but you know, that just is what it is. Most people continue right on. We roughly run the number based on this year's tax rates, just so they get a picture of it. Cause when they see, you know, $500 a year, nobody's that concerned. When they see 4,000, people have a little bit of pause, especially because if they're escrowing, obviously Jason or somebody else is going to come calling saying we need more money in our escrow account. So give us a check. And if you already don't have enough cash flow, that could be a little disconcerting. But we haven't had anybody walk yet for tax purposes. The rest of the things are, you know, your typical. This is a target closing date. And I can't really stress that enough, no matter how hard I try. And I know the agents are doing the same thing on the other side, that this is a target. In Onondaga County and any place that uses this real estate form, it is on or about, which almost always means it is after. So target that date all you want. Please don't hire movers. Please don't schedule, you know, washer dryer installations or any other deliveries on that date, because it's probably not going to happen. As much as we try and we push and we want it to, it's unlikely. The timeframes are starting to come around a little bit because the big delays were abstract and survey, which I'll get to in a little bit. But either way, there's still no guarantee that it's going to happen on that date. It is rare. It was even rare before COVID, and it has gotten even rarer since. So target date, we try to make sure that everybody has a place to lay their head if for some reason we don't hit that date, right? That you have a friend you can stay with, or you've got, you're getting post-closing possession, or you're in an apartment and your lease doesn't end at that point. So that's one of the other big things. We try to go through the kind of bank clear and title clear because they're two very separate processes. And I know other folks do this too, agents, banks, but it somehow never registers, no matter how many people tell them that, you know, once Jason on his end says you're financially ready to go because you've given us your W-2s, we've checked your credit, your good credit risk, we're down to do this loan, we still have to do our thing. And that clock, it started before Jason finishes his side of things, but it's kind of running concurrently. And then we have our backed up timelines. So I will get to that as well. But so that's the email, kind of going through generically what we do here. Once everybody's happy and comfortable, they have had all their questions answered, we send out the attorney approval letter to the other side. At this point anymore, they change. There are very few changes that happen to them most of the time because people don't like it. Sellers can walk away because you have made a change in that attorney approval letter. The approval letter, if there are any contingencies, is deemed a disapproval. So then everybody has to work together. I will say there are attorneys who don't send them at all.
I was going to ask you that, because isn't it if you don't hear anything from the attorney, it's an automatically approved attorney approval automatically?
Yep, that's here. In other places, it's different. Like Monroe County has a different way that they do it. The Mohawk Valley form, I can't quite remember. That one could use some work because it's pretty old. But they're different depending on where you are. So, but here it is definitively, if you don't get it done, then you waive it. Okay. And everybody's moving forward with the contract that you have in front of you. So after that happens, we kind of sit quiet if we're a buyer for the next few weeks, right? Because the buyer is going through Jason or whatever lender they're using to get approved and all that good stuff. So we're quietly waiting. For everything to go. If there happen to be home inspections, which we'd like to see, then we're waiting for those to come back, appraisals, all that stuff. Once mortgage commitment comes in, we then send that to the seller's attorney. They usually get it too. Banks are pretty good about looping everybody in nowadays. And then the seller will send us their title package, which is inclusive of the original abstract, which is updated to date, an updated survey, and then maybe a proposed deed and a couple other transfer documents. So go ahead.
Well, I was going to say, it's funny when you said as the attorney period, you sit there and you wait, because for our buyers, that is like pins and needles and they feel like they're missing something. So that's when they start bothering Steve for that binder, because they know they're going to need it. And Steve's like, when are you going to close? And we're like, we have no idea. Or they're calling Rob for the financial stuff to say, we think we have enough money for closing. They don't know what to do with themselves in that time period, right, Jason? Because they're trying to get you everything, but they want to close and they're looking for that additional information. So it was funny when you said we sit and wait, because I tell them that is the slowest point of the process, is right after the home inspection contingency and is met and they start applying for the loan. So what would you say that typical time frame is, Christy, like that somebody has to wait?
It depends on the bank. Some issue their clears to close super quick. On the bank side, the bank clear to close, I should specifically call it that in hopes that it will kind of enter the universe and all the buyers will hear it and kind of start to understand what that means from a timeline perspective, mostly for their like personal stress and kind of anxiety to bring it down, because it is a stressful process. But it can be as little as like a week. I've seen some get cleared to close in a week, and it can be as much as like 30 days, depending on the bank. Obviously, the bigger the bank, the less local the bank, the more likely it's to be on that outside time frame. If they're not a bank that's here, they could require different things of even us from a title perspective or an attorney perspective, which adds time. Because sometimes we have to go out and get additional things to make the lender happy, because usually they're using us to close because they don't have a local closing person, which is fine. We'd prefer that, but the additional things are kind of a pain. So it is the slowest time. It is the most quiet time, because all the buyers are doing is kind of paperwork, right? Digging things out, getting things to Jason, and we're just waiting. So once we get the package from the seller, then that's probably the second longest time frame in all of this, because depending on the abstract, which at our office, we actually sit and review. Some other people have title companies do it. That's fine. But we like to do it so we can really know what's in there for a buyer, because if there are covenants, we want you to know about those, right? These are things you cannot do with your property.
Yeah.
So you might want to know that, especially in like a Radisson, where, you know, there's all sorts of things. And if you haven't seen those, granted, at this point, there's really not a ton you can do about it, but you can at least be aware and kind of make sure you don't violate any of those moving forward. So that, depending on the size of the abstract, like some are like this thick, some are this thick. We have to go through every page, look at everything to make sure from when it was, you know, Farmer John's giant lot way back in the 1800s all the way down to today, where it's your little lot, that actually belongs to you. There aren't any open mortgages. There aren't any judgments. There isn't somehow a gap where we're missing two people transferring property to one another where we can't say that you actually get it. So that can take a couple of weeks sometimes, depending on when we get it. And obviously there's other ones that are there too to work with. So we look through that. Then we write up what's called a title commitment, assuming there's a bank involved. The title commitment says, hey, bank, we're going to cover you. The title insurance is going to cover you in the event that there is a loss because there is an old open mortgage that everybody missed, something like that. Or, you know, Joe Smith had a deed stuffed in his drawer that he never recorded, which is technically a valid transfer. He just didn't put it on record. So the title company would make sure the bank is covered and everybody's okay moving forward with it, because probably Joe Smith just wants some money.
You know, I do have a question on that, because another thing that comes up close to the end is if there's a judgment against a person, because that has to be cleared. So Jason, I'm going to throw that to you again. I'm sorry that I keep interrupting, but if there, a lot of times I know you guys look for bankruptcies and stuff, you wouldn't necessarily see a judgment, right? Because it's against the title of the property. Is that accurate, or do you sometimes see those judgments as well?
If it's on the buyers, we do our due diligence on the buyer buying the home. So we know, you know, if they have any judgments or outstanding things like that on the property, we probably would not know that until the, you know, it surfaced from, you know, any of the attorneys involved. So, no.
That makes sense. Because the one that I'm thinking about it in my head, it was on the seller side. And the interesting thing was it actually wasn't the seller, but had the same name, same middle initial, right? Yeah. So you have to make sure it's not that person. And that person has to sign or something that it's actually not them, correct?
Yep, that's right. And I will tell you that the traditionally, you know, if we have a bunch of judgments on the seller side, then we can get away with just an affidavit that's, you know, me saying, yeah, I'm not that other person there. I've never lived at that address, et cetera, et cetera. But sometimes people have definitely passed affidavits where it's not true that they are not that person. And that affidavit is only as good as the paper it's written on, really. Like, you know, we can clear it from a title perspective so the bank is happy and all of those things, but that judgment is still outstanding against Susie Jones. So there's, and that has to be cleared up. It really should. So we try to do it by affidavit, but we typically will look at it, especially if it's a very unique name, like Jason Miller, probably going to flag a few here and there. You know, pick any really unique name that you would like.
That's why I got married, because my last name was Smith and I was getting flagged
all the time. I bet. Like, my name's relatively unique. There aren't a ton of Christy Brightmans in the world. So if one pops up and I say, no, that's not me, people could be like, really? You're going to have to get, we've said you're going to have to give me something more than that's not just you. Like, that's not going to cut it, because your name's just so specific that I have a hard time buying that there's more than one of you in the world. And if you tell me it's a dad, son thing, then that's fine. But you got to give me something more than just, no, that's not me. We had one that was like a Susie Jones, and there were a ton, and one of them happened to be against him, but he signed an affidavit saying it wasn't. Okay. So, yep. So those things happen. But on the seller side, those have to be cleared up. Technically, on the buyer side, they don't when there's a mortgage coming through, because the mortgage always takes priority over those judgments.
Okay. That was going to be my next question. You read my mind, Christy. I was going to throw that right back out there. So
we tend to clear them up, especially if it's like, you know, $150 traffic ticket that they forgot about, that they got, you know, 5 years ago and just never cleaned up. But technically speaking, they don't have to, though the bank may ultimately want them cleared up, just because they need to know that they're not going to be paying out other funds, I'm guessing, Jason, while they're paying off the mortgage. But from a title perspective, from my world, they do not have to be paid. If they're on buyer side.
So once you review the abstract, and there's a survey, obviously, right, that typically the seller pays for, and that comes through. So you're doing all that. If there's no judgments, no issues with it, what's the next step? Or you've cleared everything up, right? What's the next step that happens in the attorney world of the transaction?
So after we've gone through everything and it looks good, we've got our title commitment ready, everything's ready to go, we send it to whoever's representing the bank. Sometimes that can be the same office. Sometimes we represent certain banks. Other times it's another attorney in town. All fine. But we get them that package. And then the bank starts their title clear process. Once their attorney gets that package, that's when kind of everything starts to really roll. Because once they get it, they will look at it. It's a pretty quick overview. They look at the title commitment to make sure that it's going to be clear when they get there and that there's nothing really crazy outstanding. And then they go run it through whatever their back bank process is. Some people use other clearinghouses, other people do it all internally. It depends, but they run it through to make sure everybody's happy and they're ready to close. And then we finally get to schedule sometime on or about contract close date, which usually means after.
After. So with COVID, are we back? We're still not back to where everybody's like sitting at the closing table, right? It's still a seller sign. Does the seller's attorney come to closing now, or is it still all done through the mail? Just curious.
Most of them are still sending through mail, because I think most people liked it. It was one less thing to have to schedule in the day. They just send a package early and not have to come. They will come if they really need their checks for closing, because they're trying to do a simultaneous, then they'll show up. Yeah. To pick them up, which is fine. We did have a closing, God, it was last week, where there was two, four, six people in the room. So it was me, because we were bank, buyer's attorney, the title company, or somebody kind of helping the title company, the two buyers, and then the seller's attorney all showed up. It felt a little strange, I'm not gonna lie. Like, I didn't quite know what to do with that. But That's the process from the buy side. On the sale side, it's much easier. Like I said, we send out our email And then we're asking you, do you know where your abstract and survey are? Most of the time, people don't have a clue. What's an abstract? What's a survey? Fine. We'll usually take some time to try to ping the usual suspects of title companies to see if we can't track it down. Because it's obviously much cheaper and more efficient to go with the original abstract that is currently here rather than creating a new one. And time is always of the essence in these things, even if the contract doesn't specify. So we try to get them done as quickly as possible and find them and start the update process, because COVID pushed it back from, you know, what was potentially a week to a month if you needed a new one, to 4 to 6 weeks even for an update. Yeah. So we were so far behind that we needed to get them going much quicker. And even sometimes I was asking people if they had an electronic copy so I could start to review it from a buyer's side, because that was really that would, you know, save a couple of weeks in the middle part there as we're leading up to the end. So seller side, we get the updates done and then we send the title package and then we wait. So sellers are kind of in that weird period of buyers where we were talking that they are going through their financing process and kind of just waiting. And we're just quiet. Sellers are kind of like that the entire time. Like, yeah, you get us your abstract and survey, and then we'll call you someday and say, oh, by the way, we need you to come in and sign documents because you're basically ready to close.
That is 100% accurate. And then on our side in real estate, we're just, you know, like a weekly update. Well, I don't really have anything to report, but we didn't want you to think we forgot about you.
Yep.
Right? It's kind of how it goes. Mm-hmm. So Jason, Rob, and Steve, I'm going to throw it out to you because I know you all are homeowners, right? So you've been through the process, or you're in an industry where you hear those stories. So can you think of either from your personal experience or something that you've heard, like a question for Christy that you think that people might benefit from hearing the story, knowing the answer?
I have a real quick question. Is that what, if I have a buyer, okay, at what point do they contact you, Christy? Is it when the contract's officially signed, or, I mean, when do you come into the process? When should they contact you?
It's usually once the contract's officially signed. Okay. Your agent will usually inquire because there's a space on the contract that says, like, what attorney are you using?
Right.
So they'll usually ask them then so they can put the information there and everybody then knows, and then they'll send it out accordingly. One thing that actually the Monroe County area does that's really nice is they have a whole information sheet that's, you know, buyer, like full contact information for buyer, seller, each attorney, each real estate agent. And it has to be filled out as part of the contract. So it always comes across with full information. Whereas here we're like, who's representing so-and-so? Not sure. So sometimes we end up having to send approval letters to the agents because we don't know who's representing anybody, which makes it tough. But that's usually when we would get involved. We've had a few people call early to say, hey, getting ready to sell my house or looking to buy. Is there anything we need to do? And that we're just kind of on notice, but nothing really happens on our end until they actually have a contract because there's really nothing to do. But that's usually when they call.
Okay.
That's on the seller side too, right? If we have a listing contract, we don't really send you anything until we have a purchase offer on the house. Like, we're going to ask them, who are they going to use when we get a purchase offer? But you don't really need to see the exclusive right to sell or the agency office exclusive, any of that stuff, right?
Nope, don't need to see any of that. The only thing that would be nice on a seller side to have advance notices so they could start to work on finding their abstract and survey, which I know you guys ask about.
Yeah.
Yet somehow, even by the time they get to us, they're still like, what's that?
Mm-hmm. Yep, they're focused on that get the offer, and then what's next?
Yep.
So what about you guys, Steve, Jason, anything for Christy? Any stories or questions?
Question, how often do you guys find that there is like a cloud or there's some sort of issue with the title as you're going through the process? You know, so is it like 1 out of 10? Is it like 1 out of 100? Like how frequent is that?
It's not as infrequent as people would like to think. I wouldn't say it's, I'd say it's maybe there's a, like 25% of the time there's something, and some issues are easier to deal with than others, like an outstanding judgment, right? We just get that paid off at closing, unless for some reason they don't have enough funds to pay it off, then we have a different story. But most of the time, especially right now, people are getting plenty of money to pay off most of that stuff.
Do you find that, like, it's usually, if you do find anything, it's since the last transaction occurred versus stuff that might have occurred in prior historical times, like when 3, 4, 5 generations ago, whatever. do you see that still? Like, is it as frequent or as the 25%, or is it?
So most of the time it is coming from the owner immediately preceding the current seller, right? So the person right behind, most of the time. Somebody thought something was supposed to be taken care of and it wasn't, so now it's our responsibility to handle it. So that's typically where it lands. Some of the older stuff can usually be taken care of in other ways, so it's not a huge deal. But, you know, we try to tidy it up. Old mortgages, like, you know, you've got your banks, like an on-bank mortgage. On-bank had been sold 20 times over. Things probably got discharged, but it's not officially recorded, so it's not something that we can say actually happened. So then we have to go through the process of getting a duplicate discharge with no proof whatsoever that anybody's paid it off, because these people are long gone, right? Nobody's got these files anymore, so we're all just hoping that it actually was paid off. And that process to get a duplicate discharge take between, well, I think one took as much as 60 days. And that's, you figure, this is basically as we're at the tail end, and we're now telling you, oh, by the way, we've got another 60 days to wait because we need this duplicate discharge that has to get here for us to be comfortable, unless somebody can say, oh, no, I've got a HUD one that shows that that mortgage was supposed to be paid off. Okay, fine. We can move forward. But it happens a decent amount. And unfortunately for you, Steve, you get the bum rush at the tail end where we're like, okay, you're scheduled to close. We need your homeowner's insurance binder.
Now,
we have to have the figures in by tomorrow at noon to make our trade guidelines. So where's your homeowner insurance binder?
Right. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. now it's real, as opposed to 3 weeks prior when it was like, yeah, I have to cross this off my list because somebody else said so.
Well, and I think it's a point that we should probably put in our earlier emails to the buyers to say, hey, look, start thinking about your insurance, because to your point that your insurance premium could be higher than you think because of prior claims or whatever, just be prepared. So that way, at least, you know, when you do make that phone call, like, hey, ready to close, it's all kind of teed up.
Yeah, definitely. do you guys find that like older, like kind of like more rural areas, perhaps with like a decent amount of acreage or like historical sort of farms that have transferred over the course of time versus say like, you know, your prototypical subdivision where it's, you know, it's passed around enough to where, or the entirety of the subdivision has enough sales in it where there's likely not to be anything too surprising from like 17, 1800s or whatever, let's say, versus like, you know, some sort of rural area where, I mean, I've seen stuff that I've insured where I've looked at the parcel map and they've got stuff on one side of the road and they've got stuff on the other side of the road. And somehow that's still part of the same parcel, even though it's bisected by a street. And someone not knowing that could easily just be like thinking this side of the road is their property to sell, have no knowledge of the space across the street that might have once been farmland. They've never, it's all just trees now. No one thinks anything of it. They end up owning it, right? But then they sell off a parcel that suddenly is no longer recorded as part of the sale. And there's just like a sort of orphaned piece. And I think to myself, like, well, that would never happen in a subdivision because, you know, you're pretty much 75 by 110 and that's about it, right? But in these situations, I look at it and I'm like, wow, that could actually, like, you know, bite somebody if they're not being careful about, you know, how far back they're looking and tie things together. So is that likely to be more the place in the rural areas where you would see that sort of situation?
Most of the time, right? Subdivisions are pretty clean. All the subdivisions are relatively new. There can be some issues in subdivisions. The ones that we typically see are road dedications, because every subdivision, all the roads that wind through it are supposed to be given to the town at some point. So that way the town is responsible for maintaining them. And you have the public right of access over them to get to your house. Sometimes we don't see that the roads are dedicated, which, you know, usually if they're on a subdivision map, we can ensure over it. But the idea is we're also like, well, who's maintaining this thing? At the end of the day, like, are you going to be responsible for going out and plowing your street, Steve? Like, I don't think anybody wants that. So we'll usually call the town and ask, do you maintain this? They say yes. Almost all the time, even if it doesn't happen. But the thing that always makes me nervous is, even if you kind of push to kind of the outskirts of Baldwinsville or any, you know, kind of main suburban area and get to those kind of more rural parts. I'm just on the outsides. You've got, you know, Shelley owned this piece of land for 100 years, like between the family, and they just kind of kept passing it down. We gave, you know, little Timmy a slip here and then little Jenny a slip over here. Those are where we see lots of problems, are those interfamilial transfers where everybody thinks it's cool. No worries, my house can be here. I'm going to put my driveway over here. It's all great because grandpa owns it. No big deal. And then somebody sells. And then it's not so great because nobody paid attention the entire time. Like, we've had people where their driveways are on somebody else's lot, and that's their only way of access to their garage. So we've had to negotiate easements with really unfriendly people to get them to allow access, because they couldn't sell their house without proving that there was access to that garage, because otherwise, what are you going to do with that garage? We had a lake parcel. It was a beautiful lake parcel. Like, this building wasn't great, but it was a double lot. And cottage, vacant lot, really nice. And there was a strip in the middle. They were two lots. The vacant lot was, half of it was owned by an uncle, come to find out. And the other half, there was like a 20-foot strip that was owned by multiple predecessors in title. They were still around, but they were like 90. And our people are like in their like 50s, because this came from their mother. So they had to go track them down to get them to give them that parcel. So yeah, flying to Florida to go find people to sign off quit claim deeds, because everybody thought this was just fine. Nobody looked to see that, you know, grandpa had given away an easement to cross this the entire time, or that the uncle never gave up his piece back in the day. So that transaction took 2.5 years to close and was 4 years late.
Wow.
Crazy. We had the situation occur, I don't know, maybe about a year ago, where the buyer really wasn't a buyer so much as that they were sort of inheriting the property from their grandparents. And while there was financial consideration made, it wasn't a typical, you know, arm's length transaction. So it turned out that while the primary house was on one parcel, all of these outbuildings, which weren't that far from the actual dwelling itself, you know, there were a couple of barns, there was a nice large 3-car garage. Well, they were all on a separate parcel. And so we actually ended up being the ones to catch it, only because as we were combing through a prior insurance declarations page, there's this other address that shows up. The other address is on the side of the street, other side of the street. So it looped around, picked up other property before the road went through, but all of these other buildings technically weren't part of the address that we were about to insure. So if something happened, we would have covered the house and thought by extension, we were going to cover the 3-car garage as other structures. But once that 3-car garage was off the property, it was no longer considered a what they call a related private structure, because it wasn't related anymore. It was a completely different structure on a completely different piece of land, unrelated to the house on the parcel in which this person transacted with. And it was now severed from the property, thus severed from the insurance policy too, had it not been picked up. So we had to like scramble it, like, I don't want to say the last second, because we were able to catch it early enough on, but it changed the, it took what would have been probably an $850 premium and turned it into like a $2,200 premium with buildings that they decided they didn't want to cover. So we had to omit them and stuff because they were in kind of bad shape. But it changed the entire sort of trajectory of what the policy was supposed to look like. And I want, like, so I think about that and I think, okay, well, if they completed that transaction, you know, from like an sort of inner family sort of situation where it just sort of like passes along, but that wasn't caught. But eventually, you know, somebody says, all right, we're just going to sell this to someone outside the family. And at that point, I could suspect that, like, what an interesting sort of development that would be on your end, as you're like, yeah, well, technically, we don't know who owns all these garages and stuff.
Yeah, that would be a cluster. Who it was, right? Whoever held it last in title, and they could be long since gone, right? And then that means we have to run down to their estate. And if they didn't really have much and they never filed an estate proceeding, then we're like, oh, okay. Right. then it's a lawsuit, technically speaking. It's an Article 15 that has to be filed to say, okay, we got to find out who owns this and we got to make it go away. Because it's really supposed to go this piece. Everybody just forgot about it for decades upon decades. So I can't say that's not possible. It's very possible that people forget about things and just move on. They think it's included as part of this whole thing because nobody checked and everybody's just passing it along. It's not good.
Yeah.
Now, we had, back in the beginning of my career, I had somebody take pre-possession because they had to get out of their apartment and, you know, things were taking a little bit of time. We thought we were about a week away from closing. Everyone did. And at the last minute, kind of like Steve was talking about, it came up that there was a piece of the property that my client was buying that was still technically owned. The grandfather divided everything up. And there was a piece of that that technically wasn't the seller's right to sell, but we thought we were buying it. And I mean, it turned out by the time you tracked the person down, he was fine. He hadn't been using the land, you know, and it worked out. But I think that pre-possession lasted almost 3 months before, oh, wow, before everything was signed off, because even though he didn't care, he also wasn't motivated to do anything, you know, about it, because there was no, he was working, he was doing that, you know, it wasn't his top priority. So it just took a long time to track him down, to have the conversation, for him to go to an attorney to make sure he knew what he was doing, to, you know, and pre-possession seems like a great idea until all of a sudden you're basically paying rent to live in the house that you thought you were buying. At the end of the day, it all worked out. It usually does. But those last minute parcel questions, like Steve brought up, they really can delay the closing by quite a bit, you know.
Usually. Yep. Yeah. And
Jason, this was somebody that you had worked with me back in the beginning, and it was the lock rate. Do you know what I mean? So the loan comes into question. Like, how long can you extend the loan for in something like that? I mean, what do you see on your end, Jason, whenever we do have these abstract or survey things come up at the end?
Yeah, it's not fun to deal with, because typically when somebody locks an interest rate, it's tied to a financial security, and those have expectations. So there's costs to, you know, to extend those. So you can break them. So like you can say, okay, well, interest rates have gone down. Can't we just get the lower rate and do a new lock? Well, you have to wait because there's a commitment. So you can break it and then wait a certain amount of time and then relock in. Or interest rates have gone up. Okay, well, then nobody wants to take a higher interest rate. So that person that committed to buy that security says, we will go ahead and grant an extension, but it's going to cost money and you just have to deal with it, you know, and try and do the best you can. A lot of times people just say, oh, well, ask the bank for an extension, no big deal, not understanding that there's financial ramifications, you know, for that. So it's just one of the things we have to deal with. So we try to communicate, hey, you know, talk to the attorney, see where they're at with everything, look at the closing timeline, you know, and say, is it realistic or not? Or, you know, you try and do the best you can, but, you know, sometimes just shit happens, as they say, you know?
Yeah. When that happens, Christine, it's on the seller side. Like, it's obviously the buyer did everything. The buyer's just waiting. Is it common to go back to the seller and ask them to pay those fees, like Jason was talking about with the lock rate? Or is it kind of like, you know, just like anything else, it's a negotiation. Sometimes they will, sometimes they won't. Like, do you have a leg to stand on at all?
We typically used to go back to sellers and say, hey, look, we have to extend our rate because of X, Y, and Z on your side. And most of the time sellers, you know, would be amenable to it. Cause I mean, it's not a huge sum of money ultimately. Like, is it money? Yes, but it's not tens of thousands of dollars that they're out of pocket because of the delay. Anymore, we usually don't ask. Like, we say we'll try, but it's probably not going to happen because right now sellers have the upper hand on a lot of this stuff. So they're not willing to give anything at all. Even though, you know, since COVID, it really has been, I guess, in theory, their delay, but they can't make the title companies work any faster. They couldn't make the surveyors go any faster. So it was just a level of inequity across the board that felt unfair for anybody to be paying. I will say some buyers end up with commitments that expire before contract close date. So you will get no sympathy anywhere when you don't make that date. And you won't even get sympathy necessarily out of us, because your bank should know better than to give you, they have the contract, they're looking at it, and they should know better than to give you a commitment that expires well before your contract close date. It expires on your contract close date. Okay, fine. It's there for a reason, even though we all know, at least here, people buy them all the time.
Right.
But that's it. It's something we can ask for. Sometimes sellers will give it. Pre-COVID, it was, you know, relatively, it was when it felt fair, right? When it felt like it really was the seller's issue, that they would end up kind of being kind and taking care of that. Now it's highly unlikely it's never going to happen. So who ends up taking it? It's sometimes agents, it's sometimes the bank. If the buyer is really feeling like they should not be paying this for whatever reason, you know, to make the transaction, get across the finish line, that's what people have to do anymore. You know, which I think is unfair for the banks and the agents, because at the end of the day, this wasn't your doing. This wasn't really anybody's doing necessarily, right? These things, like Jason said, shit just happened. These things come up. There's nothing any of us could do. We don't have a crystal ball. If we did, like, it would be very, very different. We're all just doing our best. So unfortunately, but we all end up having to deal with it sometimes.
No, absolutely. And to your point, you know, obviously, like I've mentioned, I work with Jason a lot, and, you know, we have that conversation, and sometimes you just get in at the nick of time, right? Everybody knows that lock rate date's coming, and it just, everything falls into place, which is obviously the best case scenario for everybody. So, any other questions or thoughts, Christy?
I have a real quick question, and this probably pertains more to Jason at a later date, but Christy, is there anything I can do from the financial advisor side for my clients to help your process go along? I know you don't get into the financial data and stuff like that, but is there anything I can start having my clients gather to help you?
I mean, at least if it's a seller side, you could really help by again having the same conversation that the Shelleys of the world are having with them, and that's finding your abstract and survey, because those are going to be the biggest things. And a lot of times, depending on how long they've owned the home, it depends. Like, some attorneys used to keep them back in the day, which is a terrible practice if you ask me. Some people have title companies, some people kept them themselves, and, you know, they were super organized, so they know exactly where it is, or they've got everything stuffed in random boxes and nobody knows where it is. So if for some reason they can't find it, and after you have that conversation, and maybe they'll pay more attention to you than they do to Shelly or even myself, if we have a preliminary conversation before a contract, that would help the process a ton, because that's the one big thing that gets held up. People don't want to spend the $900 that we roughly quote when we say it's going to cost to get you a new one. They're like, oh, well, let me look. I'm like, okay, well, look. And then weeks go by and we're like, we still haven't found it yet. You know, we're doing our diligence, calling up the title companies. It takes a few days for them to get back to us. And nope, still haven't found it. Well, let me just check one more place. Like, I have a random safety deposit box that's in a bank. It's only in Albany. I'm going there next week. I'll look. And, you know, it's just wasting time is what it's doing. So then when we get to close to contract close and everybody's like, where are we? Where is this? What are we doing? We're like, yeah, we just sent the abstract out because they finally found it in some random box in their uncle's garage way up top in the Eve storage. So that's really the thing that can help the transaction go smoothest. And it takes some pressure off of them when they're, you know, trying to get ready to move, right? They're picking up and trying to buy something else probably, or moving out of state, which is stressful. It's just one less thing that they have to deal with. So if they can find it and put their hands on it, even a HUD one from when they bought would be helpful, because that usually lists a title company. So we have some place to start. Prior attorney, also helpful, if that attorney's still around, because we can usually call them and say, hey, where did you typically send these things? Because, again, we all have our own ways of doing things and our own internal processes. So it's a place for us to start that isn't just generically kind of throwing the widest net we possibly can in hopes that we can.
Okay.
It's funny she says that, Rob, because when she said that they would probably listen to you, because they come into your office, right? And they're probably all in on what you're saying all the time. So if you mention abstract and survey, it's probably like ding, ding, ding. Whereas I say it, they're still thinking, what house do I want? Or who's my buyer? And how much am I going to get? And by the time they get to Christy, they're already thinking about the closing. They're, you know, so when they're coming and talking to you about that financial planning of should we sell, you know, where are we going to go, that whole kit and caboodle. If you would say that, I bet you it would. I didn't think about it till Christy said it, but it would definitely probably be a lot more, they'd be in the mode to look for it at that point, as opposed to when they've already started working with the two of us, you know? And if they haven't found it, they won't even get to Steve if they can't find it or get it recreated. Perfect. So, well, anything else, Christy, anything that in the process that you thought of in answering these questions you want to throw back out there, or guys, do you have any additional things for Christy?
No, it was very thorough. Good job.
Yeah. Thank you. Thanks for all the information. So, all right. Well, it is once again Monday here. And if you guys didn't catch in the beginning, I'm in Memphis, Tennessee. So, and for once, I think Syracuse, New York has better weather than Memphis, Tennessee. So you guys enjoy the sunshine.
And I mean, better being really hot and humid.
And humid?
I'm not complaining.
Well, then maybe my 82 and a little bit of a breeze as I go sightseeing today will be nice. Oh, yeah. Perfect. All right, everybody. Talk to you soon. Bye.
All right, bye-bye, guys. Thank you.
That's it for this week's episode of Real Estate I Love It. Be sure to subscribe and leave a review on whatever stream platform you're using for your podcast. See you next time.